Hello, and welcome to In Conversation With, the Lancet HIV's podcast. I'm Peter Hayward, Editor-in-Chief, and for the June edition, I'm going to be speaking to Denton Callender of the Sexual Health Programme at the Kirby Institute in New South Wales, Australia, about a study looking at the population-level effects of treatment as prevention among a large cohort of gay and bisexual men who have sex with men. Before we go to Denton, I'd just like to draw your attention to a couple of other pieces in the June issue. We have a great article looking at safety and efficacy of different treatment regimens used in pregnancy, and a review of pre-exposure prophylaxis adherence. But now, let's go to Denton.
Hello, Denton. Thanks so much for joining me.
Thanks for having me, Peter.
My pleasure. Your study, published in the June issue of the Lancet HIV, looks at the population-level effects of treatment as prevention among men who have sex with men in Australia. Could you perhaps start by giving a description of the HIV epidemic in the country?
Ever since the first case was diagnosed back in the 1980s, the epidemic has been pretty firmly concentrated among gay, bisexual, and other men who have sex with men. There are, of course, other people who do get HIV, but even to this day, about 75% of new infections each year are among this population. So it's been where a lot of prevention and management efforts have been focused.
Is the epidemic particularly concentrated in certain areas of the country? I guess Australia is sort of quite unevenly distributed. So one might imagine that there's sort of particular pockets where the epidemic is concentrated.
Yeah, as you say, Australia is a huge country, most of which very few people live in. But when we're talking about the epidemic among gay and bisexual men, as in many other parts of the world, you do find it concentrated predominantly in urban centers. Again, it's not to say that people in regional and rural areas don't experience HIV in various ways, but for lots of different reasons, including migration patterns of this population, most of the stuff is going on in cities. But Australia is actually pretty good. It has a rather robust network of clinics, including publicly funded sexual health clinics in all corners of the country that provide HIV care and testing. So it's pretty good coverage, even though it's a very widely distributed country.
Right, great. Thank you. And so then your study, you're using data from the Taipan cohort. So could you tell us a little bit about that cohort and which areas of the country it covers?
Yeah, so Taipan is a study that was established back in 2015, and this is right around the time that Australia's national HIV strategy really embraced treatment as prevention. So early administration of HIV treatment to people diagnosed with HIV. And my colleagues and I, led by Rebecca Guy and Mark Stuve, basically used an existing Sentinel surveillance network, so an existing health monitoring system, and then just sought to build it out to make it bigger and better in a number of key ways, which most importantly for this study was really expanding our coverage of clinics and laboratories that were diagnosing a lot of HIV, testing for a lot of HIV, and were located geographically in close proximity to communities of gay and bisexual men. So we worked to identify new sites, to recruit them, to get the data systems up and running. And then as another really key and exciting part of this expansion, and really what makes Taipan, I think, so cool, is we implemented a new system that facilitated de-identified linkage of health records. So if Taipan is about extracting routine health data, we know that people often do move to different clinics or get different services in different places. And so for the first time through Taipan, we were able to link health records between services and over time in a way that's really very efficient and also very secure. As I said, it's totally de-identified. So with these things together, we could essentially establish a longitudinal cohort that spanned a long period of time, 10 years in this case, to really see what the impact of these changing policies and changing understandings were on the HIV epidemic overall.
That's great. Thank you. And so over the course of your study, you did see some substantial changes in sort of the HIV measures in this cohort. Could you perhaps describe the key findings of your study for our listeners?
Yeah, so I should say this study was really focused on two states in Australia, the two most populous states, Victoria and New South Wales. It also tends to have the largest concentration of gay and bisexual male populations. And we saw, looking at a population level, that from 2010 to 2019, so over that 10-year period, HIV treatment uptake increased significantly. And very importantly, so did the incidence of viral suppression. And the way in which we calculated viral suppression at a population level was also about in considering and incorporating those who weren't aware they had HIV, so undiagnosed infection. As I'm sure you know, I mean, undiagnosed infections are contribute disproportionately to new transmission of the virus. So for us to get the most accurate measure, we thought it was very essential to incorporate undiagnosed estimates into our overall accounting of viral suppression. So viral suppression increased over time. Undiagnosed infections decreased a little bit, not a lot, I would say, but a little bit over time. And all of this ran parallel to a major decrease in HIV incidence. So all these things together were starting to tell, I think, the story of HIV treatment as prevention and the changes it had over time among gay and bisexual men in these two states.
That's really interesting. And interesting that sort of the decline happened without a substantial decline, as you're saying, in the estimated undiagnosed population.
Yeah, and I would say the estimated proportion, so I say estimated because, you know, we got it through mathematical modeling based on some population prevalence studies. It did decline a little bit, a couple percentage points over the 10-year period, although that's not a lot. So it's less than 10%, but it's, you know, it's kind of going down slowly. But what we did see as the incidence of repeat testing, so high-risk men testing more frequently increased, that was associated with declining undiagnosed infection. So yes, this study is really a lot about treatment and the power that it has, but I think it also speaks to the incredible significance of testing. You know, it's called treatment as prevention, but of course, testing is a huge part of that as well. And we can see in a small way the benefits of that to this bigger public health picture.
Yeah, absolutely. It's always worth reinforcing the importance of getting people into care.
Have
an effect on HIV. Other studies that have looked at sort of treatment as prevention and test and treat, it can be referred to as well, and just trying to get as many people onto treatment as possible, have not always been able to show sort of such positive population level effect of treatment as prevention. And some, I mean, think of Pop Art in particular, I guess, is perhaps what the most high profile one, have had some disappointing results. Are you sort of fairly convinced that the findings in your study do show that treatment as prevention is having this population level effect in your cohort?
Yes, I would say that. I mean, you can never know something with certainty. And I think there are certain methodological limitations that we need to consider as well, including that, you know, this is in many ways an observational study. That's kind of the only way you can do a study of an existing large public health intervention like this.
Yeah.
And yes, our results do stand in contrast from some others, including some RCTs. But those were done mainly in sub-Saharan Africa, where you have much more generalized epidemics, and there's a heterogeneity between populations in terms of risk, their behaviors, where they live, who their partners are. And a lot of these issues weren't relevant to our study, where you have a very concentrated epidemic. And, you know, yes, there is heterogeneity among gay and bisexual men and who they sleep with and what they do, but we were able to account for those kind of individual level differences as well. So I think it's kind of apples and oranges, right? Do I think that we can say that this would be as applicable in somewhere like South Africa? Perhaps not, but we do know, and I think it's rather convincing, that in a very well-resourced area like Australia, with a concentrated epidemic, treatment as prevention did work, or it's strong. Our results strongly suggest that it worked. I don't want to get called out on that, although I think you probably know what I think about it or how I feel.
Yeah.
But that being said, I wish to make clear, like, the uptake of treatment was incredibly high. Like, 98% of people in the later years who were known to be HIV positive were accessing treatment. And you don't see that in many places around the world. So for me, it speaks to the potential of treatment as prevention, but also the incredible investment that it takes to really start ramping up to those population level big picture effects. Not to discount, of course, the individual level benefits. These are incredibly important and well established, but we always need to, I think, keep an eye on the big picture as well. And I guess what this shows at the end of the day is that Australia's really, I think, incredible investment in things like treatment and testing have really paid off for them. And perhaps there are lessons there for other countries that are engaged with similar kinds of epidemics.
Over the course of your study, you talked about essentially a 10-year period. And during the course of that, PrEP was introduced in Australia and actually had quite sort of substantial uptake amongst the population that you're looking at. Did you observe an effect of this?
For sure. So yeah, PrEP became widely available in Australia in 2016, in the state specifically among gay and bisexual men. And so we were able to account for this effect by looking at PrEP prescriptions as distributed by the clinics participating in our cohort. And these were the best clinics for us to be looking at because they were the ones distributing PrEP based on all the same features that made them eligible for the study in the first place, like their patient caseload and their HIV testing and so on. So we had a really good account of PrEP. And yes, PrEP did definitely have an effect on HIV incidence. And it was really treatment as prevention and PrEP working together where you really see incidence start to decline. So it was declining steadily from 2010 to 2015. But then if you look at the main figure in our paper, you can see just how significantly things then start to change from 2016 onward. So for me, it's like they're both great and they're both best when you're using them together. The point I would like to make, I know we've paid a lot of attention in the HIV space in recent years to PrEP, and it's very exciting and it's very cool, but I never want us to forget about the needed power of treatment as well, because it was having an effect on HIV incidence for many years, as I said, before PrEP's introduction. So I never want it to be one or the other. It's definitely both, but I also don't want us to forget about how amazing HIV treatment is, including for people who are living with HIV.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Very important points there. And I think it was something that increasingly I'm seeing sort of in my work on the journal, how we hear so much about PrEP and people talk so much about PrEP these days, but it's so important not to forget, as you say, treatment, but then also other methods of prevention and how it's all part of the different strands that we can use to sort of bring down HIV incidence. So yeah, I think it's a really important point. There was some coverage of your paper and it sort of got a bit of notice on social media and some news coverage. Even some of the coverage suggesting the potential for virtual elimination of HIV in Australia. Yeah. I just wondered what you thought about that interpretation of your research.
Yeah, it's exciting, actually. I mean, Australia is really cool, a really cool context from a public health perspective, right? It's very well resourced and it's an island. So there's like kind of stuff that can happen there that you just don't see happening in other parts of the world. So I think it presents a lot of hope for this idea around, you know, virtual elimination of HIV transmission. If we continue to access the resources, and I don't just mean financial, I mean knowledge and research to really continue to push this thing home, I do think it's possible much sooner than I would have even imagined a few years ago. But at this stage now, because we have such high uptake of so many of these key strategies, it's actually going to be so much harder, I think, because this kind of like broad sweeping implementation, it's going to need to be more finely tuned now, tailored to the people who you're not capturing in these ways. And this is where I think really the questions or the issues of social justice and health equity really come into play, because in many cases, this is going to be the people who aren't engaged in PrEP or treatment are the people who are probably experiencing different and intersecting forms of oppression and marginalization in the social sense. And so we need to kind of get at that and access our social science in a really meaningful way, obviously in concert with epidemiology and clinical science, to meet these people where they are and not assume that what we've been doing because it's worked thus far is going to keep working. Now, I know that many of my brilliant colleagues in Australia are working on exactly that. But it's always a question, can we take the information from the social sciences and make it real in the clinical and epidemiological space. That bridge always tends to be a little bit trickier than we like to admit, but I do see a lot of potential there. So for at this point, it's like, this has been working. This is awesome. This investment really paid off. Let's see how far we can go. You know, let's really kind of double down. And I wouldn't want to speak to the mind of the Australian government, but I feel like they get this and they can appreciate that. So I'm really hoping that my kind of prophecies can pay off, because I don't know how you feel, Peter, but it's like, it's amazing for me to actually even imagine this in a real way. And very, very exciting. So yeah, I'm feeling optimistic, I think. What are you? Are you feeling optimistic?
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, I think, you know, the UK, similarly, a highly resourced island and making great strides as well. And so, yeah, I think it really is promising, feeling optimistic. But as, you know, as you point out, those people who, you know, who aren't engaged at this point, who the health systems haven't managed to reach and haven't managed to contact, you know, there really is a job of work to be done to do that. And yeah, as you say, it's about health equity and justice, really, that, you know, elimination tends to be, and those sorts of things tend to be based on a percentage. And you say you've done it when you reached 98. But what about the other 2%? What, you know, very positive news, but there's still a way to go. Well, thank you very much, Denson. It's been really interesting to speak to you and hearing a bit more about the study. Thank you for joining us.
Oh, thanks for having me. I love talking about this stuff, and we're really excited to see this research in the world. So thanks.
If you found that interesting, you might like to take a look at a study in our October 2021 issue, in which Denson and colleagues looked at improvements in care of men who have sex with men in New South Wales. And these improvements probably contributed to the findings discussed previously. We also have the November 2022 issue, which included several papers from the PopArt study team, in which they did a deep dive into the outcomes of that study into treatment as prevention in South Africa and Zambia. Well, that's it for now. Please remember to subscribe to the podcast wherever you listen, and make sure that you join us next month when we continue the conversation.